Welcome to episode 6 of A Legitimate Salvage, a podcast about The Expanse in which four friends slash Doctor Who fans attempt to rewatch seasons 1 to 3 before the season 4 premieres on Amazon in December. Let's go around and introduce ourselves before we launch into the discussion of episodes 1 and 2 of the second season.
I'm Jen Burt.
I'm Chip Sutterth.
I'm Katie Burt.
And I'm Warren Fry.
Welcome back, Warren.
Hooray!
Yay! And you're just in time for season 2. What did everyone think about these first 2 episodes of the second season?
I thought they had a tremendous amount of verve compared to the first bits of the first season.
Verve, you say?
Verve, I say.
Great word.
They just seem to be clipping along. Even though there's a lot of expository nonsense, it still seems to be pushing forward a lot more than the first season did.
Even when there is expository nonsense, it feels like it has more verve than the first season. It's delivered in maybe more of an exciting way.
It's like that verve is piped in.
I need some of that.
I think I will accept the statement that there's more verve if you're talking about the second one. I think the first one is really kind of expository. I felt like I was enjoying seeing the characters come together and the character conflicts in that one, but I thought that it was a whole lot of explaining.
Yeah, well, for me, I was going to say that I agree that the second one has more verve. We're really committed to this framework. But I liked the first episode more because I think it, you know, for me, it like slowed down and had like lasagna scenes and a little bit like a lot more quieter like character moments that I really enjoyed. But I think that that does speak to what your preferences are as a viewer and also maybe what your preferences are as a rewatcher as well.
I mean, for me, it was. I knew I was watching a season premiere, so it didn't bug me that they're like, as you know, Billy, blah, 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 because you kind of have to do that for a season premiere for people who haven't seen the season last season, right? So,
We were looking at this, and it aired a year later. So if you are, like most viewers, you're probably like, what happened? What even happened a year ago? In my own life, forget The Expanse.
I know.
Last week,
2016.
I have no clue.
Yeah, 2016 to 2017. Like, things are just speeding up in the real world. So,
yeah, and there were only 10 episodes, mind you. This wasn't like, a season of Star Trek and then a summer break. You know, 10 episodes, mm-hmm. and then it's gone for a year.
Well, speaking of exposition, before we launch into a deeper discussion of what we thought worked and didn't about these episodes, let's share some clever episode synopses. So I'm going to go first and talk about what went down in season 2, episode 1, which is titled Safe, which is also the episode title of one of my favorite Firefly episodes, if anyone was wondering. This aired originally on February 1st, 2017. And in Safe, we meet Bobby Draper, a Martian Marine in the tradition of Battlestar Galactica's Starbuck. She's rough. She's tough. She loves bourbon, and she's the leader of her Martian Marine Corps team. When Mars sends their team to get in a pissing match with UN ship the Nathan Hale over Phoebe Station, she's raring to go and start a war so they can realize the Martian dream of a terraformed home already. Hashtag goals. Luckily, her commanding officer, Lieutenant Sutton, whose name I thought was Button while we were watching this, is less trigger-happy. When they get to Phoebe, he fires on Phoebe Station before Earth can investigate it for themselves. Meanwhile, on Earth, Christian is knowingly playing the role Erin Wright has forced her into as Fred Johnson's accuser, while secretly hiring a spy to help her figure out what Erin Wright and Jules Pierre-Mao are up to. On the Rossi, it's time for family dinner, but first Miller and Amos have to discuss the time Amos murdered Miller's childhood friend. Nothing a little lasagna can't fix. Everyone's getting closer on the Rossi, including Naomi and Holden, who have space sex, and excluding the Eros refugees, who only seem to come out of their quarters when the plot demands. Maybe they're avoiding the protomolecule sample that the crew discovered and hit on a random asteroid in space. I'm sure that won't come back into play later. Oh yeah, and the protomolecule? It's alien.
And then we have season 2, episode 2, Doors and Corners, which aired the same day, February 1st, 2017. The Rossi returns to Tycho Station to check in with Fred Johnson. Together, they plan an assault on a communication station where the transmission from Eros was sent. Johnson recruits 50 Belters from various factions to form an assault team. He asks for the best of everyone, and it includes Miller and Diogo.
That's not the best! Sorry.
That's not the best at all. He's the best at annoying me.
I mean, you kept quiet as long as you both could, so it was admirable.
So, yeah, so they get sent in basically tin cans to board the station while the Rossi provides some cover fire. When they arrive, they find a group of scientists plugged into the Matrix, something, we don't know. Those best trigger-happy belters kill everyone but one, who Miller saves. But he doesn't save Dresden, the evil scientist who we ran the experiment on Eros. He shoots him when Fred Johnson is trying to negotiate with him. And meanwhile, back on Earth, Admiral Souther resigns rather than escalate the conflict with Mars. Christian finds him at a bar to grill him about Fred Johnson, where we learn that Johnson didn't know about Anderson's station having surrendered when he carried out his massacre. Then Souther says he thinks that he's a great guy and that Christian is the worst. So she decides to get in touch with Fred Johnson, which, yes, is treason.
Dun, dun, dun. I feel like you just need to add that at the end of every synopsis. So one of the biggest parts of these first two episodes, even though she doesn't appear in the second episode of the season, is the introduction of Bobby Draper as a character who we get a lot in that first episode. She gets the first, very first scene that brings us back into this world. What do we learn about Mars through Bobby's character? What new things, if anything, do we learn about this entire, you know, superpower that we hear a lot about in season one and meet some Martians from, but we don't actually see Mars until now.
We don't really see anything but the elite people and the diplomats and such. And this is like the grunts on the ground, right? So, so you get a different feel of what they want. What's that?
And Alex.
Yes, and Alex. I suppose, yes. Yeah. I mean, but he's kind of a special case, right?
He always feels like an outlier in some ways as a Martian.
Yeah, I mean, he's always said at least one bar stool conversation with Amos that when he was working in the Mars Navy, he always wanted to be home, and when he was home, he always wanted to be out in space, you know. So with Bobby, this is the first time that we get a good sense of this sort of, I don't know, manifest destiny sense of what Mars is.
You know,
is like.
Why they want to do the stuff they're doing, as opposed to just their Mars. All we ever dealt with before was like high up. It was like Star Trek. It was like high up admirals and stuff, and when they're on the ship and weirdo McPonytail, whatever the hell that guy's name was. So it was always people kind of on the higher end of the food chain, and she's, you know, enlisted, but on the higher end of enlisted, I guess.
Yeah. It's funny you say that too, because I feel like to a certain extent, that's what we get on Earth. You know, we don't get to see a lot of people who are just like living life on Earth. It's really the belt where we get to meet those people, or through which like normal belters, quote unquote, or like people who don't have a lot of power or who have less power than, I guess all belters have less power. But, yeah, we get to see a lot of a lot more settings when it comes to belters, and we get to meet a lot of characters who are at different parts of the belter society in relation to both Mars and Earth, I think.
Yeah, she's real gung-ho, as you would expect a Marine character to be. And I remember I'm of a certain age where my idea of what space Marines might be like was determined by Aliens and James Cameron.
Yeah, same here.
And then you may or may not have seen a show a few years later on Fox called Space Above and Beyond that only lasted for like 1 year. And that was like somebody's idea of the military who had only seen James Cameron's Aliens.
That's true.
Because
I didn't mind it, but you're not wrong.
Shows,
yeah. In that particular case, the Marines were like, they were both Marines and they were fighter pilots just simultaneously. In most militaries, that's a real huge class distinction. I don't know real world military well enough to know how Gunny Draper and her fellow soldiers compare to real military, but they're the most authentic fake Marines I've seen in a long time.
Yeah. They're fooling us well.
I know that Jen and I are fans of the reimagined Battlestar Galactica. Are you two fans? Because there's so many, it feels like there are references to the character of Starbuck and her introduction on Battlestar Galactica.
To answer your question, I will just say that I just bought today the So Say We All oral history of Battlestar Galactica, both of them, so yes.
Wow, I did not participate in that choral harmony there because I have watched very, very little.
Well, when you watch it, you can be like, oh, wow, this introduction of Starbuck has so many callbacks to the introduction of Bobby on The Expanse. Yeah, no, there's just, Battlestar Galactica miniseries that introduces Starbuck as this reimagined character, there's a scene where she is playing cards in one of the rooms and with a lot of her fellow
crewmates
gathered around. And it's so similar to the scene where we see Bobby arm wrestling her suit or whatever is happening there. just her asking for bourbon. I mean, Bobby, you know, we'll talk more about this in the spoiler section.
What? You mean we're going to see her again?
Maybe. But, you know, her character becomes so much more than any sort of, this person reminds me of someone. But here, and even within this episode, I think she is able to do that, which is really cool and is true of a lot of the characters on this show.
Yeah. Well, the contrast from Starbuck, as much as they're both drinking and kind of running, being the kind of star of their military unit, is Bobby really believes in the mission and the dream of Mars. Mm-hmm. Starbuck doesn't really believe in much. And so just those tiny bits where they show her looking at just like, this is what this valley is going to look like in 100 years. You're never going to see it. That is so indicative of who she's not just, she believes in the cause so much and is ready, like her continually pushing, like, maybe we need this war in order to realize that dream. And how has not having that war set us back?
Yeah, almost to she believes in it almost to like a scary amount. Like when you see her hyping up her team for when they think they're going to board Phoebe Station. The rhetoric they use is very intense. And seeing like a character like Sutton, who is much more measured and, you know, wise, is just gives so much nuance to the Martians, which we've already gotten in the first season. But it's interesting to see their two characters interact.
Yeah, and it's interesting to see Sutton at the same time that we're seeing Admiral Souther in these two episodes. You know, the military is not a monolith. And you're seeing both really gung-ho and combative military minds and also cooler heads. And I like seeing those contrasts.
Absolutely. It's so, yeah. Souther is one of my favorite minor characters. I really find him, and having Wynn, who's introduced, Admiral Wynn in this as kind of his, they both are representing different parts of the military and different ideas, as opposed to just having the one military kind of admiral figure and then the younger military figure. You have a lot of different. Yeah, I'm continually amazed at how many people on this show are not pushing for war, even as this plot line, you keep getting this dread of like things are escalating.
Yeah, it feels like it's inevitable in some ways, which it may or may not be. Spoiler-free listeners. But you're right. Especially like, and also seeing the military within the context of all these other power structures. You know, it's not just the military who gets to make these decisions, which is a good thing. It's good that no, you know, in theory, no one institution is making these decisions. Although we do see how that system can fail at certain points.
I also liked how Bobby is spewing off Martian propaganda, basically, about how Earthers are all watching their vid screens and enjoying free drugs, or at least one of the people in her squad was saying that. And so you just go, oh, these people have actually no idea what it's like on Earth. It might very well be that, but
I know, because I'm also like,
don't actually know
I don't
that.
Know what it's like really on Earth. Maybe that's true, you know?
Because all...
Yeah, but we don't at this point know what it's like, right?
It's so. Like, we see these shots of Mars that it's just red dust with like a dome, and then practicing for war. And then all of the shots you see of Earth are like New York City skyline with the water. And then like dual Pierre Mao's, very nice.
Very
fancy,
nice.
Very nice, fancy house.
Stately Mao Manor.
Presumably yes. Not what most Earthers are experiencing. No. So as much, yeah. But you never see.
Yeah, because we've also seen where Holden grew up, but that also is presented as an outlier.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, at this point, if you want to see working class people, they're all in space, which is kind of an interesting inversion from what you usually see in TV sci-fi.
Yeah.
But it seems kind of realistic, too, because after they do the initial stuff, you're going to have people out there to work it. Otherwise, why are you out there? And then that's what happens, right? So
who's going to get all of these resources that exist in space? Certainly not the wealthy people are not going to be doing the dirty work to get it.
No, of course, yeah. They're going to be sitting back and enjoying the spoils as they always do. Revolution now. Eat the rich. In space.
We do have this really interesting detail that we learned from Bobby that the Martian government decided to like push back the schedule of the terraforming 50 years in order to use those resources to invest in the military, basically. Which also just makes me curious, and maybe you, one of you three has an answer to this. I guess, like, where do the Martian resources come from? Is that something we know as, at least as TV watchers?
No, I don't
watchers?
Think we do.
Yeah.
I mean, I just think of, I don't know if any of you guys have read the Mars Trilogy by Kim Stanley Robinson.
Yeah, I have, yeah.
Yeah, but that, so much of that trilogy is about the fact that this is a planet with tons of minerals and resources that people are going to want to use, and who is going to control that. And so presumably they're using those to build up their society or to trade and export.
And I think they're getting stuff from the belt too, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just like Earth is.
Yeah.
I can't recall if it's been explicitly stated so far, but if it hasn't been, it's not a huge spoiler to say that basically Mars has a technological edge on Earth. Mm-hmm. Earth is bigger and has more stuff. So it's kind of a bit of a stalemate. They talk about stealth technology that up until now they thought that only Mars had and things like that. So, you know, it's sort of been an uneasy standoff with them both looking down on the belt. So it's not stretching my suspension of disbelief too much to think that Mars has got a lot of resources that they can divert to the military cause.
Mm-hmm. And they use them more effectively than Earth from what everything you can tell in the show.
Yeah.
Or at least more single-mindedly.
Yeah, single-mindedly, I guess.
So we know that the TV show has adapted certain elements from the books and brought them in earlier, such as the Christian character, who shouldn't be in the first season if they were direct, or if they were, you know, very faithfully adapting the books into the TV series. And as someone who hasn't read the books, it seems that Bobby's character actually does come in later than she's introduced in the show, like slightly later. She still would show up in season two. But I'm curious, do you think it would have been interesting to have Bobby as a character in season one, or do you think it makes a lot more sense to have her introduced in season two?
Well, without going into spoilers, she does have quite an arc in season two and maybe season three. I wouldn't be able to say at this point, but it totally makes sense to sort of TV-wise, it makes more sense to put her in there now as opposed to having sort of jumbling things up with one more character or more in the end of season one when they've got so much. Also, it's season one of the show. They don't want to front load it too much.
Yeah. There's no Martian military thread really going on beyond the destruction of the Doniger in season one. So I don't think that there's a huge call for her to be part of the story there. I think the timing's perfect now.
Yeah, it is nice as well, you know, not to do this too often, but to see the world of the Expanse expand throughout as we move forward in the story. And just to think about where we started at the beginning of season one in terms of, you know, especially being on like the relative, I don't know, now Ceres Station feels like familiar or safe in some ways, which is funny because it's not for a lot of people. It's not safe for a lot of people, or it's not comfortable for a lot of people at least. But yeah, to have such a like confined relatively to the rest of, you know, to where we are now, small scope, which is funny to say because there's already so much happening in the first episode of The Expanse. But watching that episode, it'd be hard to imagine if you hadn't read the books, like how much bigger this world was going to get. And, you mm-hmm. know, we can talk about more about that in the spoiler section because, you know, it is, slight spoiler, going to get larger even than this.
That it is.
So one of the elements of these two episodes that really was interesting for me to see play out was the further integration of Miller into the Rossi crew, which especially mm-hmm. happens in the first episode and is very different from how we see him interact with them at the end of season two, which is, you know, obviously a lot more high intensity in a lot of ways. What did you guys think of that process of seeing him in this new context, and what notes did he draw out of these other characters who are already on the Rossi and already call it home?
It's a little accelerated. A lot happens in that one episode. You go from them dragging ass onto the Rossi and going into med bay to Miller reacting to Amos having killed Simi to Lasagna and talking about cheese farts. That's a pretty that's a journey for one episode, mm-hmm. and I think it's really economical that they pulled it off. I don't know how much I would have bought it if you could argue that they needed that they could have given it a little bit more time, that there could have been a little bit more mistrust. I mean, Amos literally almost kills Miller, and then at the end of the episode, they're at table together.
That's a really good point.
Also, I like how Miller's such a fake tough guy, too. Like, Amos just wipes the walls with them. But I like season two Miller a lot more than I like season one Miller. He's less of an archetype in this and more of a guy who's gone through some stuff. Especially the whole discussion at the end where I love the bit where he's talking about whatever the cartoon character is that keeps kids out of the air vents. And that's a cartoon character that's already come and gone, and he's showing how old he is compared to everybody else.
Yeah. Yeah. Like,
even though it's a future cartoon character.
Yeah. Naomi's like, I think everyone's a little too young to remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's so diplomatic.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. I like season two Miller so much more than also, I think, because you see him integrate, and I do agree, Chip. I think the integration happens a little too quickly. He's like sadly having a funeral for Semi by himself for like 30 seconds.
Jen literally was like, that is the saddest funeral I've ever seen.
Like, it's just like, oh man.
Yeah.
Like,
this is such a heavily managed TV show. It's not like Doctor Who, which is almost purely episodic, and it really makes a difference who the writer is any given time. For episode one, for Safe, it's like they're doing all kinds of heavy lifting, from an opening monologue to the viewer that we've never had before in Miller's voice, all the way up to Christian explaining to her spy what the situation is, to Amos and Miller having it out over previous episodes. You know, there's so much establishing of characters and status quo. It's very much like, hey, you may not have seen this show before, so here's a jumping on point. I think that's part of what it takes to move Miller so decisively from point A to point B in that one. I feel a lot better about episode two in the sense that it feels more like story than like setup. And Miller is a load of fun to watch while he is dealing with being in the tin can and taking command of a fairly trigger-happy and somewhat screw-up-ish bunch of OPA guys. It's a much more interesting transition that he goes through in that second episode to me.
Yeah, it's funny actually that you talk about the difference between the treatments of Miller, because I think the first episode was actually written by Mark Fergus and Hawk Ostby. Which, were you saying, Jen, that they had written some of the other premieres?
They've written all the premieres. And yeah. They're supposed to have written the fourth season premiere.
And then the second episode was written by the two
James
writers.
I also think, I was saying to Katie earlier, it's like, there's too many screenwriting teams.
Yeah, because they're also, like, on a lot of TV shows, they'll have two credited writers, but they won't be, like, a professional writing team. And both of these like groups of writers are professional writing teams. Like these two, Mark Fergus and Hawk Ostby. That is a name.
That's definitely a name. That's a mood and a choice in the parlance of the kids.
Mood and a choice and like, a DC Comics alter ego.
Yes. Maybe they're the same person.
Well, Hawk Ostaby and Mark Forbes, they wrote Iron Man. So he probably should have written himself in as a some sort of Iron Man
villain
or something.
But they also wrote the script for Children of Men, which is interesting to think about in the context of some this. I know, which is such a good movie.
All-time favorite.
It's a fantastic movie, yeah.
Some of those, I'm just thinking of a scene like, and I haven't seen it in a while, but the Clive Owen, Michael Caine scenes where they have these discussions of philosophy. And I feel like, I don't know, I think at its best, The Expanse is able to pull off those sorts of, nuanced political, philosophical discussions too. But I do think there is, Chip, you're right. There is a difference in these two episodes. And, it's hard to tell in terms of The Expanse, I'm pretty sure, does have a very traditional American TV writer's room. So, there is a discussion, I'm sure. It's collaborative in the sense that even if there are people who are specifically writing these episodes, there is a discussion that happens beforehand with even more people involved. Mm-hmm. But they do feel very different in their strengths and weaknesses, or maybe just interests is a better way of putting it. And speaking of interests, the space battle in that second episode is so beautiful. And also,
oh, it absolutely
is. It just feels like such a, I don't know. The first season is very well done, obviously, in terms of special effects, and the budget is great. And I was curious, what it felt like they spent a lot of money on that scene and it paid off. And just in terms of,
I was like,
yeah, for me, the colors, especially within the Rossi, there's pinks and blues, and it's so beautiful. There's the shots of when the fire goes through the Rossi, and you see the sparks, the pink sparks. I'm not describing it well, but there's some visuals that remind me of Battlestar Galactica space battle scenes, but there's some visuals that don't remind me of anything, which is a feeling I love when I watch TV or movies to have, because it feels so rare.
Space. I might be wrong, but I do think it's the same special effects company that does a lot of the special effects, the space
battle. I think you're right.
That did a Battlestar Galactica.
But it's episode two, and already we've got this season ender fight from the looks of things, right? So that's what surprised me about it.
Yeah.
Also, just one tiny, tiny thing I noticed. When they shoot off the containers with the soldiers or, OPA guys, they have FedEx on the side of them, which I thought was a nice, beautiful little touch. So either these are old, old, old containers that they originally brought stuff out into space in, or FedEx still exists as a thing 300 years later. Either way, I think that's kind of a cool thing to throw away.
Although I do think it's funny, considering the show is now going to be produced by Amazon. That.
Yeah, true. Will they go back and change those like they did with the water and Game of Thrones?
FedEx has never existed. We were like, is that product placement or is it them just making a narrative choice?
It could be both.
Yeah, you're right.
That's what's kind of neat about it. They could be making a buck and doing something interesting.
That's hilarious. But by the way, space is scary AF, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So I haven't seen a lot of science fiction where they pumped the air out of the ship, out of the main cabins to depressurize, to protect them from getting shot up, because that ship, the Rossi, is full of holes at the end of this episode.
Oh, yeah.
And
it's like you said about the new visuals, like those beams of light flying through that just stay there. That was really cool.
Yeah, yeah. That's one of the things that I love about the fight sequence. It adds a lot to it that Amos is getting thrown around in the hull as he's trying to repair the thrusters. There is risk at every turn here, and I appreciate that because not a lot of other TV science fiction shows go there.
Oh, yeah. It feels like anytime I've ever had to go fix something in way less pressure of going down to my basement and being like, why isn't the heat working? It's always in some dark, weird zone like he's in, but I'm not in a space battle where there's high gravity. And I appreciate it because it's also such a contrast. And I love Star Trek, but it's a contrast to unless they're for some reason going to replace a dilithium crystal or something.
In the Jeffrey tube.
Yeah, it never quite feels as
when they evacuate.
Yeah, exactly. This is just there's four of us on the, there's the refugees in the ship that are Oh, I guess that was the first episode. They get rid of them. But they don't really outline the refugees' arcs in these episodes. No. But, yeah, just like there's four people holding this thing together, or five people now that Miller's there.
Let me think. There's Miller, there's Holden, there's Naomi, and Amos. So Naomi, Holden, Miller, Amos, and I feel like there's one more on the tip of my tongue. You said there were five?
Miller, Amos, Alex, Holden.
Oh, okay. Oh, the one who's flying the ship. That one.
Yeah, Alex. Yeah. That's his name, right?
Yeah, what's up with him?
So Alex, you know, and we also mentioned the refugees. Alex is the only one who's really paying attention to what the refugees are up to. But very few people, including the show, is really paying attention to what Alex is up to. He takes up very little space as a character, or especially in relation to the other members of the Rossi crew. So how do we feel about him at this point in the show's run? Like, what's his deal?
There's a couple of things. I love where he's sitting there talking at the bar and then just realizes that Amos is buggered off.
So good.
that was a nice scene. Also, and this is going to get a little meta, he plays a Texan from Mars, more or less. And he's the actor himself is from Saskatchewan, which was where my parents were born. And I grew up in the Texas of Canada, Alberta. So I'm prepared to cut Alex a massive amount of slack based on the character being who he is and the actor being a Canadian from my parents' home province. Which is kind of a dumb reason, but I'm still doing it.
I mean, I love the lasagna scene. I just think I love a character who's like, you know what I'm going to do? I want to make everyone dinner. Like, as much as I don't think they give him enough narrative space, I do appreciate that so much of what he does is like, I'm going to try to mediate what's going on with these other three people.
Yeah, a lot of the domestic tasks in some way. Like, the thankless domestic tasks.
Yeah, even though he's a pilot, which often, and when he is flying, sometimes they have him as, you know, making these kind of wisecracks and that kind of tradition. But yeah, I just love these, like, here's my family recipe from Mars with no good food in it.
Yeah. Yeah, like, while Amos and Miller were, like, fighting to the death, Alex was just, like, upstairs being like, what was in that recipe?
Where's the recipe card? I feel like I saved it somewhere.
Alex gets a lot of mileage out of Cass Enver's charisma.
Yes.
Yes, I would agree.
So, especially at this point and towards the end of season one, you know, the character is not given a lot to do. So, at the moment, he's kind of the Yaz of the group. But
it's a good comparison. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, for sure. I mean, talk about charisma for both characters. But he had a lot more heavy lifting to do in the early part of season one, where they were all, you know, four people trying to escape from the destruction of the Cand and the destruction of the Doniger and all this stuff. And they were more or less on an even keel. And the story's re-evolving around different characters right now. And, you know, all the Star Trek shows, you know, they don't give the helmsman a lot to do. Cass Enver, as Alex, is kind of in that boat at this point, but he's still a great character to watch when he's on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think he is used a lot in the first season in here as a comedic relief or even just like to alleviate some of the tension. And I think as they get better at figuring out how other characters can do that, that frees him up a little bit in terms of his role in the narrative. Or maybe it will. I don't know. Anything could happen. We also see in this episode, or these episodes, that the relationship between Holden and Naomi changes. And I actually wrote in our show notes the way they describe it in the Expanse Wiki, because I thought it was so funny. They say, while in a state of undress, their passion yields to sexual congress.
I can't hear that and not have it in a bot voice. Like, hey, Siri. Oh, no, there we go.
Yeah, hey, Siri, a computer definitely wrote that. Yeah. When I was watching this with Jen, they were like, I'm actually more into the Holden Naomi thing on rewatch than I was the first time. I was into it the first time, but I thought that was an interesting observation. How is everyone feeling about that?
You know, I don't know. It seemed to fit at the time. Like, I never really put a lot of thought into it.
Yeah, I think that was how
I was like, yeah, they're in space. There's four people in this tin can. They seem to be into each other. Okay.
Which is kind of how their, like, sex scene is plays out, too, to a certain extent.
Yeah, I guess it does. Yeah,
which I think...
But also, I thought, how's Amos going to take this?
It's the Star Trek Enterprise biodecontaminant gel scene between T'Pol and...
No, it isn't, because they wait a season and a half or so for this to happen, right. As opposed to Star Trek Enterprise, where it's like right off the top, and you're like, oh, come on, really?
Yeah, that's a great reference, Chip.
But we talked in spoiler space previously about, you know, whether the Naomi and James characters needed to get together for the purposes of this show. And, you know, at the end of season one, you know, they have a sort of a tender moment, but it's not necessarily a romantic one in the med bay. But I feel like the writers are setting up the new status quo in season two, episode one, and they just go point to point to point to point. I'm glad that they had that moment when they're speaking helmet to helmet. Mm-hmm. And she's asking if he's okay after Eros, and he's talking about his responsibilities to crew. So they're having a really adult conversation about important stuff before.
And it's intimate in another kind of way.
Intimate in another way. And then and they wait until after that to get into the airlock, mm-hmm. and then have another adult and intimate moment of an entirely different type.
I also like that he apologizes, and then she leaps on him after that.
Yeah. I also like that when he is having his nightmare about the protomolecule at the beginning, he is also dreaming about Naomi, like, flirting with him.
Right. That's a bit of a signpost there.
Yeah. I also like that for Naomi, in that moment, she is like, I want to avenge what has happened, or I want to... It's the first time when she's having a kind of a conversation with Holden, she's not just like, causes get you in trouble. This has always been she really kind of commits to, like, not only trying to have this intimate moment with him, but also it feels like she's letting a wall down and maybe kind of changing her, where she's been up to this point.
Yeah, he asks her if she's scared, and she says she's angry.
Yeah.
So good. Well, one of the other things, the last question I wanted to ask before we go into spoiler territory is we find out in this episode from the Christian Souther conversation that Fred Johnson didn't know about Anderson Station's surrender. And I'm curious if that affected either this time and or your first watch, if you can remember, how you felt about his character.
Not really, to be honest with you. I mean... He's kind of, at least at this point, he's in the show, but he's not, we don't know as much about him as we do about Christian, for instance, or any of the other, I guess, politically high up figures. So this didn't really, because I don't know much about the guy, really. He kind of, if you read the books, and I read the first one, or some of it anyway, you get to know Fred Johnson a lot better. And here, I don't think they delve into him as much.
I think also, I wonder how much that scene is supposed to reveal about Fred Johnson. And how much it's supposed to reveal about Christian, because she seems surprised by this information. Like, that was, like, pretty high up that was covered up. Because she's high up in the government, mm-hmm. to not know that he was kind of set up tells us something about her.
Also, he still massacred people whether he knew about surrenders or not. So, I mean,
yeah.
How great is this?
He still knew that this was a station with... children on it, whether mm-hmm. they, you know, surrendered or not. Yeah. And I also think it's coupled with Fred Johnson airlocking that guy, which is not the same as killing an entire station of people, but it certainly shows that he is willing to enact violence in order to make a point,
mm-hmm.
to get the belters, the best of the belt for his assault team.
Quote unquote, the best of the belters. Okay, we are now entering the spoiler zone. For those who haven't watched past episode 2 of season 2 and do not wish to be spoiled for the rest of season 2 and season 3, now is the time to shut off the podcast. We hope you'll come back next week for our discussion of the beginning of Season 2's Static and Godspeed. You can subscribe wherever good podcasts are found and follow us on Twitter at @LegitSalvage. For everyone else, let's dive in. So we begin in the start of Season 2 to really see how the Eros incident is already affecting the Rossi's crew and their decisions moving forward. For all of you, were you thinking about how that extrapolates out into the rest of Season 2 and Season 3 and potentially Season 4? Jen already talked about how we see Naomi like make that very, kind of have a change, a slight change in character and commitment to helping as many people and avenging what they've seen directly moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
It definitely motivates them. You see a lot of comments in these episodes. You know, Alex does have his moment at the bar about his moral obligation. So Naomi, for different reasons, they're feeling a moral obligation to avenge Eros or find out or strike a blow for truth and justice, you know, however it's going to shake out. Between that, you know, it moves some of them in more obsessive directions than others. Naomi's going to have a completely different reaction to that protomolecule torpedo later in this season than she has right now. It's turned them into a team with a purpose as opposed to just some people just sort of on the run.
Yeah, and you mentioned that decision that Naomi eventually makes at the end of Season 2 to give the protomolecule sample to Fred Johnson and therefore the OPA. And for me, watching the scene where they're debating that and she's the only one who's like, maybe we shouldn't destroy this. I didn't think that she already was like, so I can give it to the OPA. But it was interesting to, you know that she was the dissenting voice in that decision.
Knowing what's coming later, yeah.
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 But also, yeah, I don't think she's calculating it at this point. I think that's a spur of the moment, but it takes a while to get there.
They are still so much reeling from seeing the effects of this thing that I don't think any of them are. Like, I think the fact that she has this ability to be like, there could be a vaccine. Like, that's her. There could be some use for this that is not as a weapon or as an OPA kind of like bargaining chip.
That sort of reminds me of how at the end of was it this episode? Yeah, it must be because they're on the space station. That one guy, whoever the hell he is, the guy who sent all the files, the scientist who's giving his explanation as to what this is all about. When I was watching, I'm like, this guy's kind of like Thanos. I don't agree with a word of what he's saying, and I think he's very immoral, but I want to listen to what he's got to say anyway.
Yeah, we were talking a lot about his character when we were watching this because I was like I said this before in a previous episode, that he feels so much like an evil scientist trope, but it doesn't bother me, especially because we get this moment where Miller decides to shoot him, which I think is not always the decision. Definitely not the decision you see happen in real life and similar context maybe, but also not often the decision you see made in stories either. And also makes me respect Miller's judgment a lot.
Yeah. 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 More so than like Miller hanging out on the Rossi, which I do love Miller hanging out on the Rossi, I think. But yeah, it felt, you know, the idea that you would kill 100,000 people in order to get to a better future. It's in some level, I'm like, yeah, you're being very compelling, but the fact that Miller shoots him, it's like, no.
Yeah,
it's like not.
He's reprehensible, but it's also interesting intellectually what he's saying. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, totally. And that's where Fred Johnson goes. He's being sort of dispassionately analytical because he wasn't there. He didn't see it. So what do I need to do with this thing? He's probably already calculating, would this benefit the belt? I don't know if he's buying what the scientist is saying about the protomolecule being the first shot against humanity from an alien civilization, but Miller just kills that plot thread stone dead.
Yeah, which is nice.
And it's like The Shining and Scatman Crothers getting an axe, you know, at a critical moment. Spoilers for The Shining.
I mean, we are in the spoiler zone, so.
I kind of wish that I had been into the books at the time when they were first being released, because I think I would have been very surprised that, you know, that Miller shooting him would probably have been right at the end of a chapter, and I would have been like, but wait, we were going to find out what this was all about. Now we've got to find out through a different route.
Yeah, and narratively, you're right. It does make an interesting. They're not going to get this info dump from him, right? Whether he would give it to them or not.
Kind of allies us with Fred Johnson in some way, because, you know, Fred Johnson probably is like, we have this person contained. He's not like a fighter. We can keep him. He has knowledge. Let's find out what he has to say. Yeah, that moment just works so well. And I think more than anything that has come before feels like really wonderful character development for Miller, in the sense that he's a character in the first season whose judgment feels so clouded by his, I guess, like depression and like skepticism and conflicted loyalties. And to be able, like, so much of these first two episodes, especially the first one, is seeing him seemingly be more at peace than we've ever seen him, which also allows him to, like, let down, I don't know, shed a fair amount of that facade we've talked about before that he had. And to be able to just know in that moment, where it is a quick decision, that this is exactly after he's, like, you know, saved this other scientist, which probably plays a role as well. What would have happened if all the other scientists were dead? Yeah, but to be able to make that decision and not feel like he has to even check in with anyone else, just be like, which I'm not usually a fan of unilateral decision making in that way, but in this moment, he convinced me. So we obviously know that Miller's time on the Rossi is will only go on for so long. And these episodes made me sad that he wasn't still around in the same way, and also that his path did take him in a different direction, especially because I'm, like, personally not a huge fan of the, like, Miller-Julie storyline or that part of his character. Was anyone else feeling that, like, what if Miller was, like, a full-time member of the Rossi moving forward? What would that look like?
I would have loved that at the time, and I was so upset when they killed him off. But in retrospect, having gone through it once and watching it now with y'all, I think that he leaves the show at exactly the right time, because I think he could have very easily overstayed his welcome. If they hadn't figured out what to do with the social dynamic and given the character more different stuff to do, then I think he could have regressed and been something more like the character that we saw in the early part of season one. So I think he actually exits at the right time. And then I think I mentioned before, a mutual friend of ours told me that when I was moping about Miller's departure, a mutual friend of ours said, well, it'll pay off later. And I was like, oh, don't spoil that for me. And then, of course, in the episode when he first appears as the investigator, Thomas Jane is in the opening credits, special appearance by. So
yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But I do.
I think you're right, though, about the. It's interesting. During this episode, I was thinking about how Miller's, like, friction with Amos feels similar to Holden's friction with Amos, even though I think they are different characters in a lot of ways. So, I wonder if we would have had more of those kinds of, like, redundant scenes, or, like, yeah, if they couldn't even figure out how to do that, and, like, because it is based on different things. Like, he killed his friend. That's a very real, like, conflict or reason for conflict. But if they couldn't find a way to make that feel, like, completely new and original in that context, what would his, like, continued presence on the Rossi have looked like?
When you asked the question, I immediately thought of that seminal work of 20th century cinema, Big Trouble in Little China, when Jack Burton at the end, they ask if he's going to stick around. He's like, nah, sooner or later, I'd say something to make you mad, and then I'd have to leave. And that's pretty much Miller.
Yeah, so many. I think I like his, like, kind of, like, sarcastic sense of humor and, like, you know, just kind of, like, hanging out in the med bay with Holden, kind of debating things. But that couldn't go on right? Yeah,
like it's pepper. It's not the meal.
Exactly.
I'm glad we get the Miller-Naomi interaction in these episodes because we have these two Belters who have very complicated relationships to their Belter identity or who aren't, I don't know, they've both chosen lives that aren't like Belter specific, I guess, or maybe indicative of like, or common amongst other Belters.
They don't fit in basically, yeah.
Yeah. So to see them kind of like immediately have some sort of understanding of one another in that way is really cool. It would have, and I can't actually remember, maybe some of you guys remember what their, if any, like scenes are like moving forward.
They have a couple other scenes like that from what I remember.
Yeah. So we already mentioned we see Admiral Wynn in this episode, who is very much a supporting character. He is one of the many people sitting around this table during one of these, you know, many meetings that happens. This high tech, like, I don't even know, hologram board. But he is someone who's already presented in some way to have a different kind of value set or philosophy that, as Admiral Souther. And we actually see that face off in, is it season three? Was that something that, I know Jen was thinking about it. is that something that Warren or Chip, were you like, oh, this guy? Or were you like, you know, he's, I don't remember. There's a lot of supporting characters.
I had this feeling in reverse because I was watching that other seminal film of the 21st century, Catwoman, last night. And don't ask me why. But he's in it as like a thug. a very well-dressed, very handsome thug. And I'm like, who is this guy? Why do I reckon? Oh,
wow. He's, I don't like him. He's not as bad as the awful characters in Fleabag, but he is like your, he is sort of a tropey bad admiral. And I believe he is actually in on the, unless I misremember, I believe he's actually in on the conspiracy with Aaron Wright.
Yeah, I think he
is. So,
yeah.
So he's just bad, bad, and he should feel bad about who he is and what he's done.
Wow.
And I saw him in the scene and remembered that he was coming up, and I was like, I'm not happy that you're here.
Yeah, I don't think I noticed him at all in the first time I watched this. I think I was just like, he feels very much like, oh, he's the military figure that is siding with Aaron Wright. And then Souther feels like the one that almost is like the other side that Christian needs, because Christian is trying to play both sides. But then I was like, I was spending a lot of time on the Expanse wiki after watching this, being like, oh yeah, because they basically, the Agatha King episodes where that happens and there's this showdown between the different UN ships and the face-off between these two characters, I just found fascinating. I think I just find, when do military figures follow what politicians say, and when do they say, no, this is not what we should be doing? And that was, those episodes I really loved. So to know that they're already facing off in this here, and then you don't see Souther for like maybe a whole season after this. That's what I love about The Expanse. It's like someone disappears and then they come back. And you're like, that guy that resigned instead of escalating the war.
Which we do, it's not really the same thing, but we do get the introduction of Christian's like bodyguard spy character in these episodes, who has such a good arc.
And plays a, he also, they all die in the same, all three of those characters all end up dying in the same episodes.
That's interesting. I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was it like for all of you to see him pop up on the scene?
I was happy because I always enjoyed his like reluctant, sarcastic servicing of her security needs. He's just kind of like, oh, fine, I'm going to do this, but I'm not going to like it.
Yeah.
And he's just kind of a charming dude, so.
I was excited to see his character, but also that actor plays a character on Star Trek Discovery Season 2, which I think is the worst part of the season.
Right. I totally forgot about that.
Because when he showed up on Discovery, I was like, oh, hey, it's him. And then they didn't really utilize him in the same nuanced manner.
No.
So That was a bit of a harsh reminder, but it just really made me excited for all of the stuff with Christian and Bobby coming together as well. And just in general, watching the process of rewatching these episodes has been a process of me not realizing how fast this plot moves. I feel like all these mm-hmm. characters and moments felt so much longer in my memory than they actually are in the, and maybe it's because we're watching two episodes at a time, but yeah, this story just moves so quickly, but still manages to find those moments to breathe and those moments of nuance. There's a part in these episodes where we see Alex realize that one of the refugees that was on the ship, the Eros refugee that was on the ship, was on, you know, the tin can spaceship that exploded. And it's just this like very short shot, really, or two shots. And it's such an effective use of time and efficient way of telling a story and telling you something about his character in this world. And I'm just continuously amazed by the ways that The Expanse does that. Does anyone have anything else to add about these two episodes before we head into our sign-off?
Just that, once again, Diogo's heroism under fire makes him just such a valued and important member of the recurring cast of The Expanse. And this episode, what am I saying? I can't wait for him to get killed by an elevator.
I almost asked you directly about him, Chip, and then I forgot.
I saw him and I was like, oh, I have to wait that long for him to die? Damn it.
I will say that I'm like, I don't hate him as much as everyone else.
I hate him less this go around because I know he's going to die.
I love
making like positive comparisons between him and Bobby, and I was like, this is an insult.
Absolutely not.
Well, I was just kind of like, they're both very young and like have this very like focused, like naive perhaps view of their respective contexts.
I have hard eye emojis for Bobby, so I don't want this discussion to continue any further.
He has a cool headband.
No,
thing.
That is a terrible headband.
Guys, he got floated by his uncle and then left to die in the vacuum of space.
His uncle was a hero, man.
Bobby is badass and capable. He's just a schmuck who keeps lucking his way into things.
Like, he literally got hit in the face by a paintball and then, like, led to, like, his entire unit just, like, shooting a bunch of ammo.
I'm not saying I like him. I'm just saying I don't hate him, it seems, as much as some of the other members of this podcast.
However, I was very happy to see Drummer in this one. By contrast,
you know, I didn't like her at first. I think it was because it was so hard to understand her and her belter. But I grew to love her later as time went on. So through series three, I was like, I really started liking her and her take no crap attitudes on things.
I really like that actress because she was on this show, Strange Empire, that I enjoy. She was the star of that. So when she showed up, I already had a ton of goodwill towards her. I also want to know why she's like the only woman seemingly who's a part of this. It's like all men who volunteered for the assault team, which there often seems to be somewhat more gender parity in this world. And it very much stood out where she's this like just yelling OPA kind of sub-commander.
Yeah, she still gets to have power, but she's still like an outlier, like Smurfette character.
Yeah,
in that
which
scene.
Is weird.
Not in because, this world, yeah. But
she gets way more later on.
Because again, like these two episodes, you see a lot of nobody really cares about race. The one guy comments on how if the Admiral's bread was buttered the same as mine, I would totally jump on him. Like none of this just kind of happens. But you're right, this doesn't just happen. So that's a little odd.
Yeah. Yeah, it stands out.
It is another great example, though, of a character who's introduced who will become, like, such an important, or, you know, an important character later and have some wonderful stuff. Mm-hmm. But you're not sure at this point if she is one of those characters or if she is, you know, I don't know, one of the many characters who gets introduced and never really shows up again. And that is such a cool quality that The Expanse mm-hmm.
Yeah, compared to Game of Thrones, where you're just overwhelmed with people. Here it's like, just sneak them in pretty sneakily, for lack of a better term.
Thank you so much for joining us on A Legitimate Salvage. We'll be back next week to discuss episodes 3 and 4 of season 2, Static and Godspeed. Until then, let's try to behave. And if we can't behave, We tread lightly.